Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today I am very excited about our guest and the topic that we are going to be discussing. We have on Wendy Eaton, and we are going to talk about Nauvoo and get to know Wendy a little bit. If I remember, Wendy, in our emails back and forth, you had kind of concluded that this is going to be a cup of chai can't even, kind of a mix between getting to know Wendy and what brought her to Nauvoo and some of her experiences there to just talking a little bit about Nauvoo in general. So, Wendy, thank you for being on. And why don't you just give our listeners just a brief introduction of who you are?
Oh, my name's Wendy, and I live in Nauvoo. I'm the administrative assistant for Community of Christ Historic Sites Foundation and Joseph Smith Historic Site. So I split my time between helping Barb Walden with some of the fundraising and the advocacy for Community of Christ Historic Sites, and helping Kristen Mackay, who's the site director there in Nauvoo, with the day-to-day operations of Joseph Smith Historic Site.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you. I was just in Nauvoo a couple weeks ago, and you gave us a tour, a really quick tour of the historic site before we jetted off to our flight. But I didn't get to like sit down and talk with you. So that's one reason why I wanted to rope you onto this podcast. So we could have some of the conversation that I wanted to have with you. But I think that it'll be really interesting for those who listen to the podcast to just hear a little bit more about Nauvoo. So let's talk about you first a little bit. So I'm curious, were you born and raised in Community of Christ? And then kind of what role did the church play in your upbringing?
I was born and raised. My mom joined through her mother's remarriage. So she joined the church. So it's first generation on her side. My dad's family up in southern Maine have been members of the church since probably the late 1800s. I'm not that interested in family history, but I've been able to figure out that much. And so I have a pretty long history on one side and a very short history on the other. But one of the fun things that my parents laugh about, my dad was in the Air Force until I was in about middle school, and he was away at some special training at the time my mom was about to give birth to me. So he's gone. She's got my older sister, who's under two at this point, and another child on the way. So she ends up staying with her parents in Missouri. And due to the circumstances that it all ended up being, I was able to be born at the church-supported hospital, the Independent Sanitarium. So we laugh that, yeah, Dad had to be gone at the time of my birth, but I got to be born at a church historic site. So a little bit of a bragging for for my mom that she was able to handle that on her own and introduce me to the church historic sites, even if it wasn't intentional.
Literally born into it.
Literally born into it.
Oh, that's really great. So I assume that you were just actively involved in congregational life and camps and things like that growing up, or were you not?
To an extent, with my dad in the Air Force and the nature of his job and being away and training quite a bit, church was made a priority, primarily so my mom would have a support system no matter where we ended up moving to. But we were never very overly involved in church activities as far as youth camps. We were more involved in Girl Scouts growing up. It wasn't until my dad retired and I was entering middle school that I went to my first church camp. And from there, it was, I guess you could say, all downhill from there because I got heavily involved in church youth activities and youth camps at that point. But early on, not so much.
Okay. So it sounds like the church was there as a support for your mom, as your dad was he ever deployed, or was he just?
As far as he's able to share with us,
yes,
it's the military. I don't think he was ever deployed. There were certainly many instances, the Persian Gulf War, that we knew that the possibility was there. We lived in Panama for a number of years, and my dad's, his work schedule meant that he would be gone for a week or two at a time, but then he'd be home for several days at a time. Mm. When we moved from there to Massachusetts, he was gone a lot because he was in some very specialized training, and there would be months at a time where Mom would be on her own. And by this point, there were all three of us girls that she was taking care of. So the church ended up being a good place for her to get away from us kids. Nice. And it provided an extended family no matter where we ended up.
Yeah, some sort of consistency and familiarity. So was there any interest in church history when you were growing up? Like, was that a big part of the church story or the church narrative that you grew up with? Like these stories of church history, or was it a topic of interest from you personally when you were growing up?
Growing up, pre-middle school, well, even pre-high school, no, not at all. By the time we settled in Missouri and we started attending the Warrensburg, Missouri congregation, we had a lot of church leaders who were very invested in the Book of Mormon. So my church history consisted of, there was once this teenage boy named Joseph Smith who translated the Book of Mormon, and that's where our church got started. And that was pretty well it. It was my high school time. It was my sophomore year that I really got exposed to church history. That fall, I was enrolled in an AP American History class, one of the few advanced placement classes I ever qualified for. But our teacher, one class session was all about the Missouri Mormon War. And so he opens the class with a brief overview of the Latter-day Saint Church. And I don't remember the exact words he used. That was years ago. But he talked about, and Joseph Smith started a war in Missouri. And I immediately thought, wait a minute, this is the guy who started the church I'm in. He didn't start a war. So I raised my hand, interrupted the teacher and said, are you sure? Is this the same Joseph Smith? And he said something along the lines of, yes, this is your history. And he moved on from there. He didn't really go into much more detail. I was in a little bit of shock the rest of that class session, just like, okay, wait a minute, what does this mean? And one of the students next to me at some point, the teacher had talked about Governor Boggs and the extermination order. And then in the mid-1900s, the Missouri Governor Bond rescinding that order. And one of the other students leaned over and said something along the lines, well, it's too bad they rescinded that order. We could have kicked you all out anyway. And it was a little, on top of the shock of the news of my church history, to have one of my classmates, who I was never really friends with to begin with, so it wasn't that startling to me, but to have all of this thrown at me at once was... I ended up in a very fortunate place because within a short time after that, it was announced that the following summer, the senior high youth would be going on a historic caravan. Mm. And the guy who organized it, David Ettinger, he's very passionate about church history, and he wanted us to be as prepared as possible for this trip. It was required for all of us high school kids to go through a weekend retreat where we were taught the Temple School church history course. Wow. And so within a few months of having this experience in my public high school, I then had this very other side balance, so a much heavier balance on David teaching us a faith-promoting history. And so then the following summer, I was a part of that historic caravan. And that was my first time physically at the historic sites. I didn't think too much of it after that until I had just graduated college. and looking for a job and visiting with Lachlan Mackay, who I had met at that point, I was invited to come out to Kirtland as a summer guide. So I spent the summer of 2016 and then 17 as a historic interpreter at the Kirtland Temple. From there, that's when I really started to get passionate about church history. So that's been in the last 12 years.
Nice. So I didn't realize that you had also been a guide in Kirtland. So can we talk about that a little bit? I mean, what was that like? I'm assuming, did you just give tours of the temple and bring groups through it? Or what exactly did you do out there?
Pretty much as a summer student, your focus is giving tours. And I'm not naturally a public speaker. It took a lot of training to get me to the place I am today. And
the one thing that I love about you is, and I was going to mention this at the beginning, is just how conversational you were on the tour. It was just like, to me, it seemed like you were just, it was like putting on a glove. Like it just, this role just seems to fit you so well. So
that's 12 years of training.
Yeah. Saying that it doesn't come easily.
Whoa. So our training was, now that I'm thinking about it, it was pretty intense. There were 5 of us my first summer that were the student guides, and Lachlan was in the process of transitioning from Kirtland to Nauvoo. His wife Kristen was already in Nauvoo, and Barb Walden was coming in as the site director in Kirtland. So Lachlan trained us, and he had a very interesting method of training at that point. I tell the new students as they come in that they're getting a much gentler version of the training than what I had. And so I think there was really only 2 in the group who had some prior exposure to in-depth church history. He took us on a tour the day after we arrived in Kirtland, and he would just lay the information out at us, pick one of us out of the group and tell us to repeat the information. So here I am, no public speaking experience. And here's this powerhouse of a church historian that it was terrifying. And the whole time we were going through the theater, and this was the old visitor center my first summer. So the training in the theater, training in the garden, going up into the second floor of the temple, the anxiety is building. Like, when is he going to call on me? Finally, up on the third floor in Joseph's office, Joseph Smith Jr.'s office, he gives the information and he said, "Wendy, it's your turn." And he laid down on the floor. So here I'm like, okay, he either realizes how nervous I am and he's trying to break the tension, or there's something else going on. But I was able to give maybe about a third of the information that he had shared with us on that stop. And then he got up and we went downstairs. It was one of the craziest experiences. And throughout that summer, my public speaking abilities just continued to grow. And the practice of giving tours that summer and then the following summer really helped train me in a lot of things that naturally just didn't come to me. So Kirtland was a pretty crazy experience, primarily tours, but also with that first summer, as I mentioned, being in the old visitor center, they were in the process of building the new one. And so part of my job that first summer was helping with some of the physical elements of setting up the new museum display. And so I spent hours in the basement of the Kirtland Temple with tape measures, paper and pencil, measuring historic pieces of the building like door frames and window frames. It was a really interesting experience spending that much time alone in the basement of that building. And then on other days, taking tours throughout the rest of the building with all sorts of guests coming through.
Wow. It's not every time I record that I actually laugh out loud during someone's story. But just that image of Locke laying on the floor in the office and you trying to nervously regurgitate information. I think I'd probably just say, like, oh, the guy did the thing in the year in the place. Oh, man. Thank you. I mean, I can't even imagine how... I don't even know. Just how special of an experience that would be, just taking through people in that building. I will say, I really admire all of the tour guides at the historic sites, because I get asked from Mormons or Latter-day Seekers or my neighbors or whoever it is here in Utah, just very specific questions about church history. Well, how come Community of Christ doesn't believe this because of this point in history? And so trying to be that person to explain how Community of Christ interprets history and interprets events, and how, you know, even if something was a thing back in 1840, doesn't necessarily mean that we're bound to it today. And that can be really hard to explain to people. And so I'm just thinking in my mind of how that would be to actually do that as a job, day in and day out, essentially just explaining our way that we view church history. I mean, that would, you just have to be on your toes a lot, I'm assuming. I mean, you just never know what questions are going to be thrown at you.
Those first 2 years were easy because we were encouraged to, if we didn't know an answer, just tell them, I don't know, and move on. Hmm. So it was easy those first couple of years as I was still learning a lot of the basics and the cultural differences of the majority of our visitors who had come to the historic sites. The cultural differences were such a challenge, and they continue to be a challenge for me at times, just to figure out, okay, am I wording this right so that it makes sense to everybody who's here? And you might be coming from 4 different Latter-day Saint traditions. Am I able to connect with all these different groups at once? So the cultural differences are the biggest challenge.
Yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, it's almost like speaking Portuguese and Spanish, where you're just like, you can kind of understand each other. You're using the same words, you're using the same names and dates and experiences, but the actual interpretation of it is just a lot gets lost. So I really admire you folks that sign up for that voluntarily day in and day out. Oh, so then what brought you to Nauvoo? Did you go straight from Ohio to Illinois, or what brought you to Nauvoo?
I didn't. After my second summer in Kirtland, I was feeling the pressure. I had graduated college by this point. I really knew that I needed to find long-term employment, trying to figure out what I wanted that to be. I was in and out of a couple different jobs at that point in time. Nothing ever really catching me as far as a passion that I could see myself doing long-term. I was working in a daycare center. My college background is child and family development. So I had been hired into a daycare situation with the Episcopal Church. And I really loved the program, but I did not get along with the director. And so that really only lasted about a year and a half before I was really, I had to get out of that work environment. And right about that time, Barb Walden had been asked to become the executive director of Community of Christ Historic Sites Foundation. So she was leaving Kirtland, and they were bringing Ron and Ann Romig into Kirtland to be the site leaders to run things there. And I had been in contact a little bit with Barb, and she had asked if I would be willing to come on for 3 months, just help them get through this transition in the fall of Barb leaving and Ron coming in. So I did that in the fall of 2009, and it ended up perpetuating, and I stayed on a temporary basis for about a year and a half. I just kept renewing that internship and staying on and falling more and more in love with the story. But again, 2011 rolled around and I'm like, I've got to get a real job. I need health insurance, all those fun things that go with being an adult. And so I told them, no, I need to leave. And that evening, I felt so heartbroken that I would be leaving church history and the physical site that it was a pretty rough moment for me. But I went home to my parents in Missouri. I found a little bit of employment, but again, nothing that was really catching my passion. And that went on for about 3 years. And finally, 2014, the Warrensburg congregation decided to have a retreat in Nauvoo. And at first, I didn't really want to go. I thought it was going to be a really tough for me to be back on the site and then leave again. But they finally talked me into going. And not only that, they asked me to be with the group that was going down early. So he got checked in to the Nauvoo house, get everything set up for the rest of the group coming in. We walked into the visitor center and it was fairly late in the day. And I stuck my head back in the administration wing thinking, oh, maybe Lachlan and Kristen are here and I could say hi. Lachlan was gone, but Kristen was there. And so she and I talked for a little bit and she said, well, what are you doing this summer? And so it was Kristen who invited me to Nauvoo for my first time as an intern. And so the summer of 2014, I went back as an intern. They ended up meeting me in Kirtland. So that fall, I went up to Kirtland again. And over the winter, I'm like, I've got to figure out how I can make this work. I love the sites too much. I need to be on them. And so I signed up and did the internship in Nauvoo again in 2015. And we were able to find a way to keep me on site. Technically, as a volunteer, I had employment outside of the site, but I was able to stay. And I just felt so relieved. The job I had was interesting enough to keep me going at it, knowing that I got to stay on site. That continued on, and then I worked again a lot for the site during the summer month of 2016. And then the position that I'm in today opened up. And so I was able in the fall of 2016 to move into the position I'm in. And so now I get to stay full time in Nauvoo. So that's really what brought me back into Nauvoo, a congregational retreat that turned into a repeating summer employments again, but knowing that my home is with the historic sites, whether I'm in Kirtland or I'm in Nauvoo or it all opens up and I need to be at one of the other sites. So that's where I need to be.
Hmm. I love that. Thank you so much for sharing. So let's talk about what your role is in Nauvoo. What exactly is it that you do on a day-to-day basis?
The day-to-day basis is pretty boring. It's a lot of financial, a lot of scheduling. It's skills that I've had to really focus on developing in myself as I've moved into this role. With Historic Sites Foundation, again, it's primarily advocating for the sites, raising money for the sites, helping to get volunteers to come out and spend their retirement out at the various historic sites, giving tours. I get to stretch a little bit in that area, but it's primarily I focus on incoming donations and keeping in contact with the regular donors about thanking them for their support of the history that we're trying to save across the United States. I occasionally am allowed to escape from the desk and I will get out and give tours. And that's where it falls more on my side with Joseph Smith Historic Site specifically. Kristen Mackay, as I said, is site director, and we've been working a lot on expanding what the site can be. This last year was our centennial, 100 years of continuous guiding in Nauvoo. And so we had a photo display recognizing some of the big moments and major people over the last 100 years. We had a couple different special events that happened. One was specifically with the foundation. They had their board meeting in Nauvoo just a couple weekends ago. And I gave them a special tour. It was even colder than the weekend you were here. So we kept the tour inside. It was a photo tour in the theater where I just covered some of the how we obtained these sites, what the initial plan was for how we were going to use the Nauvoo House, how we were going to use the Mansion House, and different ideas of what the future could hold. So that tour really focused on that, but then acknowledging some of the dreams that we have today for the site, the events and activities that potentially could happen in Nauvoo to continue helping people to connect with the history. One of my favorite things that we did with the centennial, we started a Sunday evening congregation in the Red Brick Store. So the Red Brick Store, it's a reconstruction of the original building, but when Joseph Smith III was beginning his leadership with the reorganization, he was pastor of the congregation that met upstairs in the Red Brick Store. So we were able to recreate that congregation. We focused our worship services on the enduring principles, the mission initiatives, and events of church history that we could easily pull into a worship setting. We opened it up to the public. We didn't do the best job of advertising. We really only had about 12 to 15 a week, but that was still a pretty good number. There were days that we would have a mixture of Community of Christ, members from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, members from the Restoration Church. We never really knew who was going to show up, but it made for a very interesting experience of how do we have worship in a space with we don't know who's coming up or who's going to show up and where their background is going to be. And how can we make the stories we tell on a regular basis, how can we put those stories into a worship experience? So it was a lot of fun to be able to do that. And we hope to be able to continue that in summers to come.
That's fascinating. And I really want to be a fly on the wall there. Oh, that sounds great. Okay, so can you just kind of walk us through Nauvoo a little bit? And I'm curious to know what exactly are the sites that Community of Christ owns? And then if you want to give a little bit of background maybe on how we obtained some of those sites, I'm particularly interested in the Nauvoo House. I don't know if that has an interesting story beyond what I would just assume would be the story. But just walk us through the buildings that Community of Christ owns and the sacred spaces that are in Nauvoo.
So we'll just start with the Nauvoo House because in many ways it does start there. Alexander Smith, so one of Joseph and Emma's children, he's the one who was born at Far West, Missouri. So during that very tense period in the Missouri Mormon War, he is at a reunion across the Mississippi River, and he wants to visit Nauvoo. So he catches a boat, crosses the river, and he sees his childhood homes. Because he grew up in primarily the mansion house, he and his wife raised their family in the mansion house. And he had been the one to encourage his stepfather to build a place for Emma, essentially to retire to. He says something like, build a cottage for my mother to spend her quieter years here in the last few years of her life. And Emma's second husband, Louis Vitamin, he does not do things in small ways. He always went above and beyond. And his idea of a cottage was to take an existing construction project from the 1840s and remodel it into a home for he and Emma. It's essentially a three-story house, lots of stairs, lots of space. And so it's not what you would think of as a place for an older woman to spend her later years in comfort. But it's where Emma spends the last about 10 years of her life. She dies in that home. Her funeral is held in that home. And Lewis's son, Charlie, after Lewis's death, he is able to obtain the house. It's starting to get into some disrepair, and this is when Alexander comes into the picture. He wants to see something done with these properties. He describes it as a waste place, and they really need to get a foothold into Nauvoo, once again, we as in the church. And so he starts talking with the presiding bishop, and over the course of about the next 10 years, the church would start to take an interest in doing something with Nauvoo. They have managed to hold on through family connections to the mansion house, but they don't specifically own the block that the homestead is on. And Charlie has the ownership of the Nauvoo house. but they're able to purchase the Nauvoo house from him. And a couple moves in and they start the process of looking over the grounds. This is now, just before the 19 teens. And they start to look at, how could we use this space? What do we need to do with this? And quickly the attention shifts from the buildings to the graves of Joseph, Hiram, and Emma, which for Joseph and Hiram, they're still unmarked graves at this point in time. There are family rumors that now president of the church, Frederick Madison Smith, he has a vague idea of where the remains of his ancestors are, but nothing definite. Frederick visits Nauvoo at a reunion, and he starts to catch this idea of, yeah, we really need to establish where these graves are so that the public can come and view, because by this point, you'd had about 10 years when full-time missionaries essentially were established on the site, cleaning up, repairing the houses, hosting the first of the tourists starting to come through. And Frederick wants to see the graves better taken care of. This is his family. This is what most people are coming to Nauvoo to see. And so they start looking at raising funds to establish some kind of memorial. And this leads to another trip he makes to Nauvoo in 1927. And they start the initial search for the remains of Joseph and Hiram. They find them the following January, and the graves are marked for the first time. And this is approximately 80 years after the deaths of Joseph and Hiram. They're marked for the first time, and there's an interesting back and forth on how accessible these graves are going to be to the public. There are iron fences around them at times. There are a little more open chain link fences around them at times. It's an ongoing process until the 1990s, when the cemetery as it looks today was really opened up to the public. So it's really the Nauvoo House and the cemetery are where the church history site gets started. But in the purchasing process of the Nauvoo House and the transfer of ownership of the homestead lot, which includes the cemetery, to the church, they start to establish the homestead and the mansion house kind of at the same time. There's initial repair and maintenance done in the 19-teens just to get them to where people can come and see the buildings. There's a further push to get them better decorated to represent the history in the 1920s. And then again in the 1950s, they're looking at, okay, we need to improve on these sites. We need to improve on the stories we tell. It's been a continual story of improvement in how the buildings are preserved and how we tell the story on the site. So it's been interesting to see the development. The Red Brick Store is a bit of a late addition to the historic site. The original structure was taken down in the 1890s, and it stayed just an open pit for a long time, eventually gets filled in and becomes one of the focuses in the 1970 of the archaeology projects that get started on the Nauvoo properties. Archaeology has been a big part of the historic site since the 1970s. They find the foundation for the Nauvoo, for the Red Brick Store. They find the foundation for a three-story brick stable that existed in the 1840s. They find the foundation for one of the sites of the Times and Seasons from the 1840s, which is one of the newspapers the church had at that time. So you start to get a collection of existing structures that were taken care of with the mansion house, the homestead, the rebuilt Red Brick Store, and scattered, fenced in pits of locations of structures that we know were once there, but they haven't been reconstructed. So they're sites we maintain, but we don't necessarily talk about them on tours because that it would expand our tours quite a bit to have to take them all the way down to where the Times and Seasons was. The Red Brick Stable that was founded early in the 1970s, at this point in time, they're looking at bettering the visitor center experience on the site. And there's initially an idea of reconstructing that brick stable and having the visitor center be there. But for whatever reason, and I don't know, I haven't found that reason yet, they decide to build a visitor center, which is the one that is now on the site. It's a little bit away from the rest of the houses. That one opens in 1980. So it's a little bit of all the different buildings that we have and some of how we've established the historic site in those places.
That's super interesting. When I was there a few weeks ago, well, and I will say that I have been to Nauvoo a couple times before as a teenager, but this was the first time that I'd been back as an adult, having gone through a faith transition. I'm now a member of Community of Christ. And it was just interesting to kind of stand in the middle of that and map it all out. And I was curious about, you know, the pockets of just space between, say, the homestead and where the red brick store is, you know, like what was in between that. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about how we know where some of the buildings were, but we just don't necessarily have those buildings anymore. So that's really interesting. Did you say what year the red brick store was reconstructed? I may have missed it, or I'm just curious.
Red Brick Store, it's reconstructed in 1979. Its official opening is 1980, and that was for the sesquicentennial, so 150 years of the establishment of the church back in the 1830s.
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting. So I'm curious to hear what your favorite thing is about working with the historic sites. It sounds like both Kirtland and Nauvoo are very, very meaningful to you. Why do you feel like you belong there? What's your favorite thing about those spaces?
As I think about the impact church history has had on me and how it didn't really make too much of a difference when I was in high school, except to kind of put my high school teacher in his place, that it wasn't just Joseph Smith that started that war. There were more conditions at the time. But I've had history really connect with me. All these stories we get to share that happened 150 some years ago, but they still help me to figure out where I'm at today and to work through struggles I might be having. So when I take people through these buildings, both in Kirtland and in all the different buildings in Nauvoo, to see some story that I share, there's this light in their eyes that kind of flickers on that something has connected with them. And for the majority of our guests, I don't know where they're coming from. I am not the best judge of being able to pick out, okay, what faith tradition within the Latter-day Saint movement are you when they first walk in the building? There are some people that are able to do that. But for me to share a story and it clicks with them and it helps them in some way to make sense of something. I had a group that I was giving a tour to, I think it was late this last September, and it was one of the big bus groups. So it was like 50 or 60 people all together. And I had taken them over to the Smith Family Cemetery, given them the information, and let them go into the cemetery on their own. And one of the youngest members of that bus tour, I don't know exactly how old she was, I'd say late teen, maybe early 20s, she stopped me. She's like, you said something about Emma Smith and her call within the elect lady revelation. And I didn't recall telling that story. That's not one that I typically tell in Nauvoo. And it's one that came up sometimes in Kirtland, but I said, yeah. And I reiterated the elect lady revelation and paired it with some of the Relief Society activities and how it seems that women in priesthood roles, it seemed to be something that was almost getting started in the earliest days of the church, women having these very authoritative positions within. When you read the Elect Lady Revelation, it's using language that we use in Community of Christ to talk about ordination and priesthood responsibility. And so she and I just had this moment where we were able to connect. And I did happen to know that this group was an LDS group coming through. And she was very hesitant to ask me too much more, especially when the tour director came by not long after and started talking to me. So she kind of slipped away. I didn't get to continue that conversation much with her. But to see that kind of moment happen, to have just a very small element of church history make an impact in somebody's life, that is what I absolutely love about being on the site and getting the chance to share these stories.
Thank you. I can just picture that going down. And honestly, it kind of gave me chills a little bit. Just knowing that, you know, a place that has been so controversial in our church history, which I do want to touch on in a little bit, can still, you know, good stuff still happens in Nauvoo today, which is exciting. So you tell a lot of stories on the tours. You have, I guess it sounds like you're in a little bit more of an administrative role right now, but you still got the stories in your head and can still share them. What are some of your favorite stories, maybe one or two, however many you want to share, just that have come out of this time period and from Nauvoo that you've shared on tours?
So currently my favorite Nauvoo story is not one I share on tour.
Perfect. Let's hear it.
The homestead is my favorite place to tell Nauvoo stories because there is so much that happens there. And in the rush of when we have tourists coming through Nauvoo, we just don't have time to reflect on the multiple generations of church leaders and their lives in the homestead. We really only get to talk about Joseph Smith Jr. and that's it. But in preparing with the centennial and gathering all these different stories, we came across a story of Joseph Smith III that, especially given the Christmas season and all the sappy romantic movies that are going on right now, I just love this story. Joseph III, as he's a young man, he talks in his memoirs about a couple different romances that he has. But then he talks about a moment when he goes into a candy shop on Yonge Street there in Nauvoo. And across this candy store, he sees the most beautiful woman he's ever seen. It's a young Miss Emmeline Griswold. He sees her again sometime later. He and his brother Frederick are in the buggy and they're going up the hill. He doesn't specify what hill. I suspect it might be the hill leading up towards the temple. He talks about how it had been raining and that it's really muddy outside. And so as their buggy is going up this hill through the mud, he again sees Emmeline picking her way across the street through the mud. And he turns to his brother and says, essentially, get out of the buggy. I'm going to pick up Emmeline and I'm going to offer to escort her home. And someday, if I'm lucky, I'm going to marry her. And within a few years, he does marry Emmeline. He talks about how the first kiss they shared was the day she accepted his proposal. And then the second kiss they shared came on the day of their wedding. They were married by one of the Presbyterian ministers in town. And as the minister pronounces the ceremony, they've come to the end. They're about to say the "you may now kiss the bride" moment. And the reverend leans in to kiss Emmeline and congratulations before Joseph gets to kiss her. And he says something along the lines of "after me, if you please." And he leans in to take his second kiss from his now bride before Reverend Waldenmeyer, I think is his name, is able to congratulate the couple. It's just one of those very human stories of Joseph III. And this is the years before he becomes active in the reorganization. The reorganization is starting by this point, but he's not involved. Not long after their marriage, I think it's maybe about a year, Joseph III and Emmeline move into the homestead. They establish that as their home. They've had a daughter by this point in time who they name Emma Josepha. So you get all these Emmas and Josephs running around the homestead. And he begins his association with the reorganization. He's very insistent on staying home in Nauvoo, even though the church headquarters would be better suited somewhere else. And he's there for the beginnings of the reorganization. It's such an important story for Community of Christ members. And I just don't get to share it very often. Every now and then the moment comes up and I'm able to talk about Joseph III and the beginnings of the reorganization, but not often. So I'm glad I got to share it here.
This makes me want to have you on Project Zion again to just talk about Joseph III.
There are a lot of stories that could be shared about him.
Yeah. Well, and when I was taking Community of Christ History 1 and 2 in our seminary program, learning about Joseph III was fascinating. And I got a hold of, I don't own his memoirs, but one of my friends and fellow peers does, who lives locally. And I borrowed it for one of my papers. And I had a really hard time just sticking to the topic of what that particular paper was, because his memoirs are so fascinating. And I really need to get a copy of them and just read it like a novel, because there are some stories.
There are some really great stories in his memoirs.
Yeah, I was looking up everything on polygamy and Utah, like going in the index to see like, what all did he say about it? There's some stories. Oh, boy. So like I mentioned, Nauvoo can sometimes be seen as a pretty messy time in history. I know that one of the main reasons why my husband and I made the transition from the LDS Church to Community of Christ was just kind of coming to realization about the messiness of the history, and that maybe the pretty packaged version that we grew up learning was not accurate. And I know Community of Christ has gone through a similar transition with when we interviewed President Emeritus Wallace B. Smith, and I think he talked about how history used to be very sanitized. And, you know, in the 1960s, Community of Christ started opening up to maybe some of the realities and some of the faults in our church history, and letting go of some of the certainty and the need to be right and the need to have the only prophetic impulse and the only priesthood, etc. But that was all kind of sparked by this, let's take a look at our history honestly, which is something that I really, really appreciate. And I think I've mentioned on the podcast before that my first real interaction with Community of Christ was when I went to reunion and Locke was the guest minister. And so it could not have been more perfect, because history was such a place of woundedness for me. And so to be able to hear Locke Mackay openly talk about some of these things and how Community of Christ views history was very, very healing and beneficial for me. So with all that background, what are your thoughts on the Nauvoo period? How have you been able, I guess, to be honest about the history that happened there and just the messiness of it, and maybe some of the power corruption that happened, or however you want to label it, the secrecy, things that just kind of maybe got a little bit out of hand. How are you still able to have it be a beautiful place? And I guess, how have you kind of reconciled that history in a personal way?
It's very easy on tour for me to stick to a very positive view on church history when I realize that for many of, especially the families that are coming to Nauvoo, the parents, no matter what faith tradition they're coming to, they see this as a priority of something their children need to learn. And so it's very easy for me to present as honestly as I can and as positively as I can the history. But that doesn't mean that when I get back from a tour, I don't face my own struggles with the church history. Having an incredibly sanitized version of history, or maybe not even sanitized, a reduced history growing up, and then learning it in a very shocking way in high school, my high school years, it's something that from day to day, it just depends on where I'm at with a certain element of church history I might be focusing on or a question that a visitor had asked. There are days that I'm perfectly fine with the craziness that happened in Nauvoo because I look at any honest delving into history is going to be messy. It's not just church history. It's American history. It's world history. There is a whole lot of messiness that is there to deal with and for us to learn from. And then there are days that I can't stand the things that happened in Nauvoo, the extreme militarism that's happening and the egos that seem to be just inflating in some of the church leaders. And on those days, it's very hard for me to sit in my office because just outside of my office is a portrait of Joseph Smith Jr. And so he's staring at the back of my head. And on these days that I just don't like him, I turn around and there he is looking at me. Not only the fact I go home and I go past his houses that evening, and it's just, there are days that it's just really hard to comprehend how things could end up the way they did. But then reminding myself that there are so much to be learned from our history and not letting power get out of hand, keeping church leaders in check and keeping them honest and open with the membership and allowing for personal expressions of what's happening. Not that long ago when they started talking about we're not a people with a prophet or a prophetic people, giving that power to the individual members. I sometimes think if that had been the case at times throughout church history, maybe things would have happened differently. But yeah, some of that messiness, it can be a mess to just work through, but it's so important to keep working at it. And that's one of the ways that I'm very fortunate. I can't take that messiness and ignore it because the very next day I might be going out and giving a tour and somebody's going to bring up that very thing that I'm struggling with. So I need to be on the ball. I need to have studied this and be as ready as I can to help someone else who's struggling with something that I'm struggling with, just to work through those and not get disaffected. I hate the thought of throwing everything out just because there's one or two things at a certain moment that really are just terrible things that happen with the people. There's some of those instances. I brought up the militarism that happens, which has been an interesting one for me to personally struggle with, my dad being in the Air Force. And my dad is one of the most peaceful people I know. But to look at the militarism of the church, have this own pride in my dad with the service that he gave, that he thought was important to in his working career, to try to balance all this out and make sense of it. And when you look at the militarism of Nauvoo, there's so much fear that it's coming out of the experiences in Missouri, the mass evacuations that are happening in Kirtland to get to Missouri, and then the very settlements in Missouri into Illinois. It's no wonder that militarism became so important to many of the people to have that source of comfort in this enormous army to protect you from hopefully these terrible instances never happening to you again. So the militarism is especially one that's hard to work with, but at the same time, it's easy for me to put it into some kind of perspective, to look at the broader picture. You can't take the Nauvoo Legion being called into martial law of the city of Nauvoo. You can't take that on its own. You have to look at the bigger picture of why do we even have the Nauvoo Legion? But what were the circumstances that caused this to be a necessary part of life in Nauvoo?
I really like the way that you articulated all of that. And I relate to a lot of it as well. That was ultimately what allowed me to consider Community of Christ as a potential spiritual home. And ultimately the only one that I felt like I could really be in, because this is my heritage as well. I have family that definitely goes back to Nauvoo and beyond that in church history. And so to kind of, like you said, throw it all away because of these moments in time is difficult. I mean, it's difficult's not the right word. It's, to me, it just wasn't an option because I'm part of this as well. And I think one thing that I really appreciated about Community of Christ and recognized early on is that history was not the theology of the church. History informed us, it shaped us. And like you said, we've learned from those mistakes and we've learned from the mess. Sometimes when I'm talking to Latter-day Seekers, I will bring up that, you know, in order to kind of learn from an issue, you have to first admit that it's an issue. And that's one thing that I really like about Community of Christ and the way that we approach history is that we don't have to pretend like it was all perfect. We don't have to pretend like no mistakes were made or that mistakes weren't made in the name of God. So it's been a difficult journey for me, especially over this last year, taking those two history classes. Not that they're an end-all be-all, but I spent a fair amount of time in Mark Scheer's books and, you know, through old articles and journals, et cetera, just kind of discovering the story that is us and being able to reconcile that in some way. I will say too, though, I don't envy you having Joseph look over your shoulder all day long. I think... I think that I would struggle with that and maybe at times just like put up a piece of paper over his face or something. Oh goodness. That's funny. We are a team Emma home and we actually got at Sunstone this last summer, someone was selling saint candles with various leaders on it, like on the glass part of the candle holder. What do you call those? I don't even know. But yeah, they were selling candles that had different church figures on as saints. And we bought an Emma one and I'm almost afraid to burn it because I just don't want it to like get ruined or whatever. So I really haven't burned it. So I think having, you know, a picture of Emma look over me would be more helpful than Joseph. So I don't envy you there.
Well, I have a slight solution. Kristen jokingly took one of the old postcards we sell in the bookstore that has all the official portraits of the church presidents, and she cut out Joseph III. And so it's a very small little picture, but it's attached to my computer. So he's looking me in the face all the time rather than his father staring at the back of my head. And the rest of the presidents are in the drawer. So if I need to pull out Fred M. for some reason, he's right there. I could just pull him out and prop him up on my keyboard.
Channel your inner Fred M. Oh, goodness.
I need an Emma one, though. I really should have Emma.
Too funny. Okay, so I guess in all of that, do you have any other thoughts, I guess, for anyone that is struggling to reclaim our history or reclaim Nauvoo?
If you're struggling with the Nauvoo or any aspect of the history, I would say embrace that struggle, because if you're struggling with it, that means there is something in there that is of value to you. And as somebody who's throwing my life into helping take care of these sites, that makes me so glad that there's something here that you value enough that you want to work through. And so, as we've talked about, history's messy. We need to struggle and wrestle with history because we need to keep it significant to who we continue to be so that we don't repeat those mistakes that happened in the past. And I am always happy when Community of Christ, or really when anybody comes to Nauvoo and has these questions and they feel comfortable enough asking me and I'm able to help them through some of that or point them to resources that they might be able to read or give them a different perspective on that difficulty. So I know it's very difficult for people to get to Nauvoo, but I'm on Facebook. Shoot me a private message. I'd be happy to help out as much as I'm able to. And there is something really, really exciting and slightly terrifying that you're involved with too. Next summer, we are going to be having a reunion in Nauvoo that is focused on history. We haven't done a whole lot of planning, as you know, probably just yet. But hopefully this will be an opportunity for Community of Christ members, for seekers to be able to come to Nauvoo, face these struggles head on, and reclaim some of that history that, again, if you're struggling with it, there's something in there that's important to you. So that's an open invitation to a reunion that it's not quite planned yet. We'll have more information to come.
Yeah, I actually want to do another episode all about that reunion before it happens and then maybe after as well. It's kind of a recap. Oh, it'll be good. It'll be good. And you know, I will say that being in Nauvoo, I was a little bit nervous to go back just because it was, again, kind of the first time that I had been in that space since I've been Community of Christ, and where that was such a deep place of woundedness for us, just feeling almost like we'd been lied to or duped, et cetera, about church history. It was just kind of breathtaking to be back in those spaces. Not that Community of Christ lied to us. I'm not saying that, but that the narrative that we grew up with just was not, Nauvoo was not as pretty of a picture. You know, I didn't grow up learning about the Nauvoo Legion, and not that like we have to be overly explicit about the mess of history, but to just be honest. And if those questions come, don't peg them as quote anti-Mormon questions, you know? So, but being in Nauvoo was just such a great experience. We were just at Camp Nauvoo, which is right along the Mississippi, as most of our sites are out there. So it was just beautiful. And I went kind of on a little solo walk one morning just by myself. And I'm sure there were some people awake, but I was up absurdly early. So I just decided to go and kind of walked along the river as close as I could get, and just kind of had this own little moment of reconciliation a little bit for myself and for this space and all of the things that happened in Nauvoo. You know, they definitely brought the church to where we are today. And I think that we can point to different cultural things and quirks in Community of Christ and kind of trace those along the path of history. And several of them have a spot in Nauvoo as well. So I really appreciate you saying that it's okay to just sit in the struggle and the mess, because that's telling us that there's probably something of value there as well. So thank you for that. Is there anything else you'd like to share before I let you go? I just think that this interview has been a delight. So thank you. But if you have anything else to share, now's your time to do it.
Oh, I can't. There are so many stories that could be shared, but we'd be here forever.
I understand. I you know, combing through those church history books and just understanding that, you know, these were real people just doing what they thought God was calling them to do. And even if we don't understand it all completely, that's okay, because we're not tied to that. So awesome. Well, Wendy, I think that's all I have for you. So thank you so much for coming on. And if you ever want to do this again, I know a gal who would be super happy to interview you again.
Hey, we can set it up with Joseph behind me.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.